This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, how are you guys doing today?
Well, still apparently in a free country for a little while.
it's all in the perspective.
That is theoretically at peace, even though it's apparently engaging with war with Russia, for God's sakes.
But, I feel an impending hawk-blocked rant.
Yes,
but, I think we'll get into it this week, I'm sure.
Yep, I'm sure we will.
Or some Living Wisdom Library ranting as well.
Yeah, we'll see about that.
Yeah, but, no, I think both this week. Yeah.
Yeah. But hey, for the moment, we don't have any bombs dropping on U.S. soil, so I'm feeling okay. Yep. I give it a 5 out of 10.
Is that the standard? That's the current bar. Like, look out the window and like, bombs aren't actively dropping. So far so good.
So far so good. That's it.
It's humans are a very adaptable species. Two years ago, we were living in a different country, and here we are, glad that bombs aren't dropping.
There you go. Okay. All right.
Yep.
All right, let's find out what we got going. Anybody else got anything interesting going?
I got a new dog.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I have a third dog now.
How did this happen? It's some stray.
She was a shelter dog. Saw the mugshot, fell in love, drove a couple of hours and just picked her up.
Congratulations, Dr. Dog.
Congratulations.
Oh my God. Darling. She's such a sweetheart. She's adorable. Her shelter name was Princess.
Yeah.
It suits her fairly well. She's just a little, probably, I don't know, 40 pound little baby pitty compared to my giant pit mixes. Doug has met my dogs who are about, 75 pounds each. So she feels very small and manageable next to them. She's just a sweetheart. She's just heart of gold. I've been calling her Cindy Lou for the Who in Whoville from The Grinch, the one with the giant eyes. because she's got big Cindy Lou vibes. So we'll see what her name winds up being. But yeah, that's my big news of the week, is my new hound.
All right. All good. So Jen gathering up just one more creature to feed survival resources when the apocalypse hits, though.
It's okay. It's part of the garden planning.
You train them to dig up potatoes.
Yeah, exactly. Planting lots of tubers for extra dogs. So,
there you go.
Yeah. No, it's farm life. It's farm life. Got to have more little creatures around.
Yep. All good. More people to warn you when the marauding, starving hordes.
Well, I mean, that's actually a really valid point, because she is a little more on the ball than the seniors.
Yes.
She's a little more on high alert when things are happening in the yard. So,
sounds great. Just what I what I wanted.
And how old?
I'll send you 1,000 photos.
How long until she's really big and ready to attack? Like, is that? I'm just trying to gauge how long you think it's going to take for things to go downhill.
Oh,
she's fully grown. She's not gonna. Yeah, she looks like a pup, but they we'll find out when she has her little take her into the vet and get her checked out. But she's I think she's a little adult dog. She's pretty diminutive, but she's fierce.
I saw some pictures. All right. Very cute.
There you go.
She's cute.
All right. Yeah. Well, that's very exciting.
I think so.
I don't. Nothing happened here. I planted a cherry tree on the side yard that'll irritate my neighbor. But
you did?
He deserves to be irritated.
That's such good news on every score. He so deserves to be irritated. He's such a douchebag. I hate that guy.
Just so everybody knows, I had a gorgeous, you know, 50 or 60 foot, probably 50 foot tree that was in the middle of my neighbor's yard that covered my house, which I loved because it hid my house. And this OCD nut chopped it down. So he should be jailed for that behavior as far as I'm concerned. So I planted a tree where he doesn't like it and I'm all happy about it. So there you go. That's fine.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. My crab apple is alive and blooming.
Yeah.
So one of the three trees that I have planted this spring is, showing signs of actual life, which is very exciting. So,
yes.
You know, I didn't kill it. The other two, it's unclear. Jury's still out.
Yeah. It's hard to be like, it's actually a little hard to be down and depressed and miserable about Klaus Schwab when the trees are blooming and, you know, it's warming up and the sun's higher in the sky. So, you know what? It's
true.
A good spring. It's going to be all right.
It's very true.
Yep.
Yes, I've been spending as much time as possible outside planting things. I think it's the antidote to everything.
There you go. All right, Nathan, what do we got going?
All right, our first question. Dear doctors, can you illuminate us a bit about the nature of sexual disgust? I'm currently seeing a man who is very much in love with me and is a good match for me in general. I like him very much and can imagine him as a future partner. However, I hate being touched by him. I feel so grossed out by it. It doesn't turn me on at all. And so I avoid physical intimacy with him. Is there any way to just get over this or should I just quit?
This is an all-timer. Man. This one belongs in the Hall of Fame, Jen.
Yeah, I have a lot of questions.
Yeah. Yeah, what's spinning through your head?
Well, like, first of all, is this unique to this guy? Mm-hmm. Or are you someone who experiences sexual disgust, like, in general in most situations? Is it sometimes and not other times? Mm-hmm. Is it related to anything specific? Is it, you know, is it a hygiene issue? Is it, mm-hmm. you know, like, there are a lot of missing factors here that could kind of fill in this answer. Because she's presenting it as if his just general overall... everything about him is she's had essentially the repulsion switch has been thrown,
mm-hmm.
And cannot be recovered, and it's not necessarily anything specific. Mm-hmm. And that's a different question than, oh, well, yeah, I hate the smell of his cologne and I can't stand being around him when he smells like his cologne. And if he stopped using it, the problem would be solved.
Mm-hmm.
So I really feel like we need to know more to give a useful answer to this question, but it raises all kinds of interesting general questions.
Hmm. God, see, this is where it's embarrassing that I'm a psychologist and Jen's like way, way more sophisticated. I just took this at face value. I'm like, if there was ever a time, if there's ever a signal that you should be paying attention to, this is it. Like evolution couldn't be yelling at you any louder. Okay, it's screaming in your ear at 120 decibels, and you're questioning whether or not anybody's warning you. Yeah, you're being warned. As long as we don't have some really striking, you know, narrowly caused factor that Jen is describing the possibility of, which is possible. If we are, if this is a global general response without any specific, you know, smell or particularly it would be smell would be the most likely thing, actually, Jen, I believe.
It's big for women. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's big for women. And it's, I learned from Diana Fleischman's work, the Jeffrey Miller's wife, mm-hmm. who's done a lot of work on disgust in particular.
Yeah.
I learned from her that disgust for women is highly elevated during the luteal phase of their cycle. when they're more susceptible to infection.
Yeah,
And so the same thing that might kind of mildly gross you out during the follicular phase, mm-hmm. during the luteal phase, is going to really repulse you, really, really turn you off. So that mm-hmm. is an important thing to pay attention to in this cycle too. It's, I think women, this is your male egocentric bias, mm-hmm. is the mm-hmm. sort of women are... they're highly sensitive snowflakes on this topic. They can be. And so mm-hmm. I really like how, I can't remember the author's name offhand, but the book is called very cleverly Come As You Are. Mm-hmm. And she talks a lot about females, sort of sexual response being driven by a series of not just gas pedals, but also brake pedals. Mm-hmm, and so mm-hmm. you can have a lot of, if you have too many brakes that are set at the same time, mm-hmm. no matter how much you're flooring the gas, the car is not going to move forward. Mm-hmm. And brakes can be everything from, oh, there's a sink full of dishes that I can't get out of my head and I can't relax and get in the mood until I take care of that, to screaming children in the other room, to I don't feel comfortable in my body, I don't feel sexy, to use smell bad and I'm not interested in you. So it's not even necessarily specifically about him, although it could be for sure. Mm-hmm. But it could also be this kind of, you've got too many brakes set, and essentially you've immobilized the whole process. And that's why I'm curious about whether it's specifically with him or if this is kind of an ongoing issue in your sex life with various partners, and you sort of struggle with this in a recurring kind of way. And that's where we would get into those deeper questions.
Yeah, the QED, get a session with Jen.
I got your chick questions right here.
yeah, so that's yeah. That's great. It's beautiful and comprehensive, and yeah, my I feel like I'm a one-dimensional baseball player instead of, you know, five-tool player. I'm a one-tool player. Like, you tell me that, and I'm like, you're in the wrong place, honey.
Because I think that's true for a male. I think if a male feels disgust toward a female partner and you can't stand being touched by her, it's like, get out of this relationship. There's nothing more complicated going on. But in female sexual psychology, there could be a number of complicated things going on. It doesn't mean that the Occam's razor isn't ultimately correct and he's just not the right guy, but it could be a more complex situation.
Holy smokes. Chicks. Complicated.
Chicks, they're complicated, man.
Okay.
Just all here, good. Just here all to right, remind, Nathan, let's remind go on. Everybody of that periodically. it's my job.
Yep. All right. Now what do we got, Nathan?
Well, we were hoping to hear you, Dr. Lau, rant out, but I guess you got overruled.
Yeah. I got a little overruled. I'm done with that one. Yeah.
All right. Our next question. Dear doctors, my ex that I was with for 1 year... that's 60 pounds overweight and objectively a 4, cheated on me, even though I'm 108 pounds with about a 0.7 hip to waist ratio and at least a 7. Why would this happen? I dated him because I thought he would appreciate how much more attractive than him I was and thus treat me well and not cheat on me at the least. The girls he has dated before me and cheated on me with were less attractive than I am. He even said they were only okay. He told me he makes 7 figures, but I estimate it to be 200,000, which is still great. So maybe that's why he thinks he's so great and better than me. He showed me the ring he was going to propose to me with as a last ditch effort to get me to not break up with him, which is apparently $80,000 ring. My guess is that it's actually only $15,000. Other than that, he doesn't seem interested in marriage in general, even though he's 41. Is he just naturally a short-term mater unless he's insanely rewarded? If he really valued me, wouldn't he not risk losing me over some random girls? Please tell me what I'm doing wrong and what's going on. I have an open loop about this and feel like I can't stop thinking about this until I understand every small detail so I can avoid making the same mistakes in the future.
Huh.
You can definitely take this one.
Huh. you stick question. Me with this. All right. Well, again, there's so much detail here that, I mean, I guess the first place, there's some things that I don't understand. Let's see, is that it seems like the girls he has dated before me and cheated on me with. So this sounds like there's been more than one person that he cheated on her with. That's the way this is worded. I would have to say that, first of all, there's many things to consider. And the first thing is that attractiveness has objectivity, but that objectivity is irrelevant between those two people. The objectivity is interesting from the standpoint of, you know, evolutionary psychology, population genetics, all that sort of thing. But between any two individuals, it's irrelevant. So the all that's relevant is their subjective assessment of the individuals that are involved. So you could have a situation where I think the guy is a 5 and I think the woman is an 8, and but she's fallen all over herself feeling overrewarded by the guy, and he's feeling calm and not too interested in treating her real casually, okay? And it's not even that he considers a flake or a dumbbell or you know, uncoordinated and can't dance or, you know, et cetera. In other words, it's not even his assessment of her mental resume. It's just that, no, he thinks he could do better, okay? And maybe he could and maybe he couldn't. But the point is that from my particular subjective assessment of those two, which is going to be my guesstimate about what would be objective relative to, you know, a bell curve of populations looking, you know, looking at those two people and running an assessment, those things can be completely different than the subjective experience of those two individuals. And so this gal is sort of looking at this thing. She had an interesting mating strategy that she's reporting. In other words, a big reason why she's with him was that she was seeking security. She wanted to have a lever, and specifically some objective lever over him that would intimidate him into a situation where he would not want to stray. So that's a strange, it's not a crazy assessment. I've heard that assessment from women before, but it's not a common motivation for women. So particularly this kind of talk, like I'm at least a 7 and he's a 4. Now, I don't have any idea what I would make of these two people. And again, my objective assessment is not really important here at all. Her subjective assessment is interesting, though. I would argue that most of the time, people aren't going down 3 points willingly. So this is a, even her reporting that her motivation for doing this was essentially defensive and security-based is interesting. So then, you know, it gets better. In other words, so we have someone who is apparently highly motivated for a relationship where she's got some control over the, you know, philandering male gene, and yet he demonstrates it. And so he demonstrates it, and rather than just saying, oh, well, I'm the hell out of here, which isn't necessarily the right response in any given situation, but for someone who is very security-oriented, and you actually played this situation very, very carefully, trying to leverage yourself into a position of intimidating power relative to, you know, your subjective estimate of your attractiveness differences. I guess I would also ask, did you get evidence from him that he was falling all over himself for you and that he considered himself to have won some great prize? Maybe he did, because if he's bragging about an $80,000 ring or whatever, maybe so. But he's also, if he slept with other people, particularly multiple ones, he's also leaking a hell of a lot of casual mating strategy motivation in the teeth of what would, in principle, from your standpoint, want to be a very heavily committed pair bond situation. So, hey, there's a lot of variation in human personality in these arenas, certainly. But I would look at this situation, once again, I'm trying to crawl into her head and get a feel for her subjective position. And her subjective position is she's a person who security and fidelity security is a pretty serious deal. And so for somebody who is where fidelity is a very serious deal, then quite frankly, I'm not sure what the hell we're doing with somebody that cheated on you. Okay. Not unless you've got a kid or two with him and you're financially completely, you know, on your knees and with no ability to change that. So I don't think that she does have children because they're not married. And I don't know what that means, but they don't have any children together. And so he makes some good money. But the truth is that shouldn't be the reason we're with him. We would need to optimize our happiness. We're going to want to get some degree of independence if we don't have it already. We need to go to the time and trouble and effort to get the skills and knowledge and capability together so that we can have a degree of financial independence. And that, therefore, then you can essentially follow your sexual desires more, you know, cleanly. Okay. So we don't have such a compromised situation potentially with some mixed motivations there. So what does this look like to me? I'm not even sure. It's like, I'm not sure why we are even questioning this other than you say, the individual says, well, what mistakes am I making? It's chasing my head around. Well, the mistake the only mistake you made was you may have missed some cues that this guy is heavily casual mating strategy oriented, but that are now evident. Okay. And so if that's the case and that this is a very troublesome characteristic for you, I would say get the hell out. In other words, if it's not such a troublesome thing to you and you can put this characteristic into a cost-benefit analysis and make peace with it for the upsides that the person brings to the relationship, fine. But this individual doesn't sound like such a person, and many women are not such a person. And so in that case, I would say, hey, you know, what are you doing? Why is this a valuable relationship to continue? So in this case, you can get our session with either me or Jen, and we can try to figure it out. All right. What else do you see there, Jen?
Yeah, I would say the only, you know, the main mistake that I see is maybe missing the casual mating cues, but also sort of expecting, maybe listening to too much evolutionary psychology and expecting a relationship to adhere to these rules of rewardedness.
Right.
I'm a seven, he's a four, therefore this should be a stable pair bond forever and ever and ever, amen.
Right.
And you're sort of staking it on that instead of, like, what I would expect to hear would be something like, my ex cheated on me, even though he's been telling me how much he loves me and planning a future with me and how we're going to live happily ever after and how he's never met someone that he loves as much as me. I'm not hearing any of that in this question. You know, I'm not hearing any of those kind of shared signals of, he really values me. I really value him for more than his sort of provisional security value and the fact that he's, you know, down enough rungs on the ladder that I feel that he's not going to cheat on me. But very likely what could have happened here is that he picked up on that kind of contempt, you know, that sort of you don't respect me, you don't admire me, you're using me, you think I'm just going to be around because I'm this kind of less attractive, overweight guy who can't, you know, who you're the best I'm going to do. And so, hey, you know, I'm not all in with you. I'll have some fun with you and maybe give you some superficial signals like here's a ring, but I'm not telling you, I'm not future planning. I'm not giving you those meaningful signals because I'm not getting them from you. And so I think that's, you know, when you're moving forward next time with somebody, you want to be looking for meaningful, authentic signs of esteem from them, rather than running it through the rewardedness calculator and thinking that you're on the safe side, because that doesn't really tell you the whole story at all.
Damn. Do you want a job as like a co-author of a book I'm writing? That's really, really good. That's really good. Yeah, I don't think I had 10 neurons that were had circle around and were seeing this contempt signaling that you're talking about, Jen. That's great. The one thing that
Also impossible he wouldn't feel that.
Yes, of course. Yes. The I can also see this interesting thing that we're seeing some more of that, the contempt signaling about she's telling us, hey, listen, he's pretty dishonest and grandiose about his finances.
Right.
And so that's a signal that's a very interesting, I mean, again, a lot of these things are there's cues in the way this person's, I mean, these questions can be like Rorschachs. And so,
yeah,
you know, it's totally. We're trying to read a bunch of things in, but Jen sniffed this contempt issue and there's a contempt in the report of basically reporting that this person is that to the best of your assessment, that they are a grandiose over-reporter of their financial capabilities. And so that, I mean, how much respect could you have for someone who they're an intimate partner who's talking about marrying you and you think that they're lying to you about their income by a factor of 5 to 1 and they're lying to you about the ring that they're going to buy you by a factor of 5 to 1? Those are astronomical exaggerations. And if you think that's true, why are we even talking about a relationship with such an individual? So right. Yeah, this you're right, Jen. You really put your finger on this. Is that this is loaded with a lot of angles of feeling in this question. It's a very rich question, but yeah, one of the big ones is he showed me the ring. Going to propose last ditch effort to get me to not break up with him. Which again, so she's signaling. You know, we don't know when she's making that decision to break up. Was it in the aftermath of finding out about the cheating or what? You know, we're in the dark about some of these things. But I guess the truth is that the solution, that's actually kind of why I think I made the comment about the beginning, that subjective versus objective, don't be thinking that these are that the mathematical laws, which are observable at the population level, don't hold with respect to every pair of individuals at all.
Yeah, not at all.
Yeah.
No, there's huge variation.
Yeah. So that's that would be a mistake to be trying to live your life there. You need to be much more concerned about exactly what Jen is saying, which is what are the cues of that other individual's subjective evaluation of you, and vice versa. That's where all of the action is, and the objectivity is nowhere.
And not through acts like the ring thing. There's something very performative about that. That's devoid of authentic esteem signaling.
Yes,
know? Like that's what you read on the back of the Cracker Jack box that you're supposed to do with the ring that's inside the Cracker Jack box is
right.
To make a big speech about, this is my last ditch effort to save the relationship and please take this. It's not, It's not coming from this really authentic, organic place of like, oh my gosh, you know, you are the most valuable thing to me and I can't possibly lose you.
Absolutely. But that's, of course, that's a, and if that actually happened, that is telling you how shallow this relationship is. And
yeah, it's shallowness. That's what it is.
What an interesting, what do you call that? Commercial trade seems to be going on, or there's another word for that, but it's a fiduciary calculation is going on inside her head. And he would be reading that and then saying, oh my God, if I want you to stay, let me show you the shiny rock I'm going to give you that's expensive. I mean, that is a very strange looking mess that sounds like it came out of 1952. You know, it doesn't have any basis in any
meanwhile,
sort of.
Meanwhile, I'll take I'll keep taking the train into the city and cheating on you every night. Yeah, it does. It has this. It's really this empty sounding sort of thing. I mean, it's worth pointing out just explicitly too that these sort of rewardedness dynamics can be affected by other personality factors too, quite apart from this whole contempt respect question. So, you know, that matters. It's not just an objective beauty question for women, you know. It's you know, his evaluation of your mate worthiness is also an evaluation of your personality, your intelligence, your the whole package. And so if that's not you can look at yourself and evaluate yourself physically and say, oh, I'm 3 points ahead, and so therefore I'm that much more valuable to him than he is to me. But you don't know how he's evaluating your personality and how that's entering into the equation, and how if your seven is his seven. Those are separate questions, but they're all related to, again, not being able to stand outside of any given relationship dynamic and quite know what you're looking at in terms of how those people are subjectively valuing each other.
Absolutely.
Wonderful.
All right.
I just have a follow-up question.
What do we got, Nathan?
A follow-up question. Yeah. One of you said that it's important to have, you know, authentic and meaningful esteem dynamics. And I'm curious if this particular couple, hypothetically, or another couple, if they are, talking about this, and he explains to her that, oh yeah, you know, I'm getting these signals of disgust, and she goes, well, I did not mean to signal that, or maybe she did, but now she's, you know, is it authentic if she now starts changing her behavior because she's heard some feedback over it, and that she didn't naturally want to be nice to him, essentially? Or I don't know if my question makes any sense, but.
Okay. This is actually a really good question, Nathan, and I'm going to wind out on this idea for a little bit. Okay. So let's briefly integrate what takes place in a psychological event. Okay. So just as the periodic table of elements is the foundation of chemistry, to understand chemistry. We could break it down all the way to physics, but the level of chemistry is the level of analysis that's necessary for chemistry problems. So we don't need to know particle physics to understand it. We need to know just a rudimentary physics. In the same way, the cost-benefit analysis is the unit of psychological events. So psychologists don't know this, by the way. That's not a known fact. But if we take this apart, this is obviously the case. So you cannot say, well, the cost is X, and know anything about how a person feels about whatever that goal is, and any idea about whether or not they would pursue that goal. None. Okay, you say the cost is $47. It's like, well, do you have any idea that they're going to buy it, or they would, you know, how they would feel about it? No. You have to only know, you must know both the cost and the benefit. If you know the cost and the benefit, then you can understand how much motivation there's going to be. If the benefit is, you know, 17 gene units ahead, the cost was 3 gene units, then we can assume that is going to be a highly beneficial ratio. Okay, so the cost-benefit analysis is what is at the root of feeling, and feeling is the precursor for action. So motivation takes place as a result of the cost-benefit analysis of any value proposition, and the nervous system is simply a device that is essentially integrating 3 sets of information. The sensory information that's coming into the sensory system, that is interacting with the universal value system of the species, that particular organism has its own individual settings. So some kids like broccoli and some kids don't, but all kids like to eat, you know, food, and they will be willing to eat vegetables if they're sufficiently hungry, etc. Okay, so you have a universal value system that gives you an instruction to be an organism of that species. Then, and that universal value system has the individual differences in your genetics that give rise to what we're going to call your personality, that of how that value system is actually calibrated, you know, as a result of the configuration of your genes, the i.e. how open you are, how disagreeable you are. All those things are essentially values, assessments of, you know, a given type of situation and then how an individual would respond to it. Like, gee, if I can go on a vacation anywhere, where do I go? To Visalia from Tulare? Or do I go, you know, to Kathmandu? Those are openness questions and different people value those things differently, but everyone values possible some degree of exploration, if only to walk around the block and look at houses, you know, six houses down from mama as opposed to next door. So we've got a universal value system. Embedded in that is your personality, because you got your particular nuances of your individual value system and how it's constructed. You have the sensory information that's coming in and hitting that the value system. In addition to that, you have memory systems that are in fact data that exists as a database that has to be put into the thing. So if we have, for example, a not very skittish rabbit, and it's on, you know, looking at a meadow, and it remembers that there's carrots. It's got a certain amount of motivation to go get those carrots, i.e. universal value system of rabbits. And that particular rabbit right this minute happens to be hungry. And as a result, he's pretty eager, and he does not actually take as much care as usual in looking for a possible threat from a predator. So now he gets run down by a predator, dives into the rabbit hole, survives. Tomorrow, when he's out there looking at the same carrots, he's now going to be more careful because he's got a memory system. And the memory system is simply an increased precision estimate about what we think the reality is, because our sensory system is only an approximation of that reality. It's just the data that's in front of us. It's not all of the data that might be relevant to what the real situation is. So that's what your memory system is, okay? So anyway, so now what do we have? So I'm going to put this all together. We've got a sensory system bringing in the information. We've got a universal value system that's evaluating the cost and benefits of various threats and opportunities, being shaped around the individual personality, that is also going to be impacted by their memory system, because the memory system is actually saying, well, the cost-benefit analysis that you're seeing with your eyes and ears and your smeller isn't actually quite as accurate. We're going to modify that and realize, ooh, there's threats out here you're not considering. So don't be so charging over to those carrots. Be a little more careful than you would otherwise be. Those computations then give rise to your feelings. So your feelings are an analog translation of the cost-benefit analysis, which is effectively a mathematical process where your brain is an analog computer that doesn't use digital operations on numbers. It uses a magic tricks in order. It's like a slide rule. Okay, it can do computations even though there's no computative process other than something that's already embedded in the system. And so, and they're not perfect. They are heuristics. They're bags of tricks. And so as a result, your feelings are the result of your nervous system's best estimate as to the value of the existing opportunities that are in front of you, or the magnitude of the threats. So in all of this, guess what we don't have? Choice. Because you don't have a choice about any of this. These are automated responses and computations, so your feelings are not subject to you actually changing them, okay? The only thing that can change your feeling, and there is something that would change your cost-benefit analysis, and the only thing that's going to change your cost-benefit analysis is new information, okay? So new information is the agent of change, okay? New information may or may not shift the cost-benefit analysis enough that it actually changes the trajectory of feelings and therefore the trajectory of behavior, okay? So when we start talking about how to fix a relationship, the truth of the matter is that all we can do is try to illuminate more information. That's all we can do, okay? There's no like, oh, we're going to do Dr. Phil's plan to fix your relationship. Good freaking luck. Okay, your relationship may have the potential to be good, but right now it's not good only because there are misunderstandings of the truth. If there are misunderstandings of the truth, then we may be able to uncover the truth if we're sufficiently sophisticated at trying to figure out how to get to it, which is what Jen and I do for a living. Okay? You just heard actually two questions, which I'm slightly embarrassed to say. Maybe I'm a little short of sleep, but you just heard a superb and subtle mind look at two of those questions and see a whole bunch of ways that the truth could actually be that I actually hadn't considered. Okay? And so, you know, and I'm not Huck Finn. Okay? So the point is that you can have truths about your relationship that you may not know. Your understanding of the truth about your relationship is an approximation. If you are confused and in conflict about your relationship, it's because you have two alternative estimations of what the truth is. And those two, or more, but certainly two. Okay? And so you're in conflict about what it is that you're actually seeing. Now, from my eyeball dude estimate of those two questions, it's like, well, I'll tell you what my eyeball estimate tells me. You're in the wrong place. Okay? That's it. I'm done, pretty much. Now, Jen is saying, wait a minute. There's like seven other little things that could be that you actually could be in the right place, but there's some misunderstandings about what the underlying truth is. However, in both these cases, I think Jen would probably agree with me, you know, the thumb's pretty heavy on the scale. Okay? Probably
well,
right.
It's part of why more of those little permutations come out with the context-free written question like this, where you're right. Not actually talking to the person and you're not hearing them say between the lines and, right. You know, with their tone of voice and all the other ways that people communicate,
right.
they know that that's not where the truth is.
Right.
And so this kind of this format lends itself to being like, well, you know, there are a couple of clarifying questions just
yes.
to rule these things out. But yes, Occam's razor is usually the simplest answer is usually the correct answer.
Yeah.
And always.
Yeah. But usually I will ask questions that are kind of very right brained. To try to get a feel
totally.
For how you feel about the partner. Okay.
Exactly.
And so,
that leaks out all over the place.
Out all over the place. Okay. So, but the point is that, so to Nathan's question, a person can perform in some way to try to, like the classic of, oh, we're going to fix our relationship. So, I could see that I upset you. You say this, I say that. Oh, let's do it differently. Okay. Well, mostly what's happening is that at the root of all the argumentation and all the conflict is what you have is an esteem dynamic crisis. So that what is actually happening is that there are cues that are being signaled that one person is not valuing the other person that highly, and the other person is picking up that on that, and they're either hurting
like
and sulking and hurting and et cetera, or they could also and likely are going to be some degree angry, and they could also very likely retaliate. Okay, so the notion of you essentially send your disinterest or disgust or lack of motivation and excitement about me, then I am going to also do the same to you. Now, it's interesting that appears to be the evolutionary best system for human beings to reproduce their DNA. Okay, so it's interesting that is generally what it is. So if somebody picks an argument with me, I get oppositional and I start looking for holes in their argument and I try to bury them. What I don't do is say, I don't say, well, wait a second. Let me really understand where you're coming from. Please tell me in detail what is it you're thinking and why it is that you said that. That is not the species that I know. Okay? The species that I know is you attack me, I'm teching you back, i.e. Axelrod and Hamilton's tit-for-tat strategy. Now, so if there's something that we want to do and instruct and illuminate it here at Beat Your Genes, it would be that your instincts for tit-for-tat strategy are counterproductive to digging the gold out of the possibility that you've actually got a relationship that's worth trying to steer out of a dangerous place that people may decide to abandon the relationship because they get caught in a vicious cycle of negative signaling and they're lost and they can't get out of it. Okay, they're in a Hobbesian trap. So that is a very distinct, you know, that is an occasional possibility. And even if it doesn't destroy a relationship, it can be a miserable month or a miserable 3 weeks if we're in such a set of circumstances. So beating your genes looks at this and says, wait a second. I can document where I have been hit by this individual. She's given me the cold shoulder. She made this little sniping comment, okay? She didn't do this or did that. So I could be in a situation where I'm feeling really irritated, abandoned, not appreciated, hurt, feeling like I want to strike back, send my signals of being really shitty, and therefore signaling that I may, in fact, withdraw and I may... there's another fancy word that we use, Jen. I can't remember.
Defect.
Oh yeah. Good. Thank God. So anyway, so I could be thinking and feeling those things. And yet, we all know what that feels like if two people get stirred up in that. And then we know what happens if there's enough goodwill and we grit our teeth and then we have a conversation and somehow we get through to a misunderstanding, and then we get resolved with affirmations of esteem signaling, and then the couple has transcended a crisis. Now, most of the time, that's not the reality of what's happening. Okay, most of the time, if we're in pretty shitty circumstances, it's because somebody really doesn't value somebody else enough for a relationship to be a really good one. And as a result, there's the sniping and problems that we're seeing are actually the result of sort of legitimate emergency signals, particularly from an individual that feels like they're not sufficiently valued. They're hurting. The other person may be disengaging, or they may not feel sufficiently valued. And what we have is a vicious cycle that is spinning. Could be spinning slowly if they're really stable people and they've got three kids and a bunch of financial entanglements and a bunch of family and a church and all that kind of crap. So it could be that it spins very, very slowly and they keep their emotional distance from each other. Or it could spin very quickly, okay, where they don't have that many things in the way, or they're inherently more impulsive as individuals, et cetera, and or someone is more disagreeable and unstable. And so therefore, it could spin pretty fast as well. But in any event, if you're in a relationship that has you puzzled and you are struggling to try to understand whether this is a place you should be or that you shouldn't be, or if it is a place that you should be or you're not sure, how would you find out? What would we do to resurrect such a thing? Because right now it's an emotional 3.5 and it should be at least a 7 to even bother to be there. So what do we do? What we try to do is we try to get to the heart of you know, essentially what, you know, where is there still a legitimate esteem in the relationship? Do we have, instead of disinterest and kind of dislike and lack of admiration, etc., but what we have instead is bitterness over some hurt feelings, over some signals that maybe have spun ourselves into a trouble, and we actually are... We're actually in trouble out of a communication crisis of a tit-for-tat strategy that's now on the loose, as opposed to any real lack of esteem between these two individuals if they could spin themselves out of the vicious cycle and back to a virtuous cycle, okay? So the long and short of it, how would we do that? Well, the only way you're going to do that is to find information that confirms the fact that you're in the right place and that your worst case scenario inferences that you're in the wrong place are sending off emergency signals and tit for tat defensive strategies. Okay. Well, how are we going to do that? well, we're going to need to have a generalized strategy of essentially crystal clear with a nice big space in front of us, and we let them begin, and we are not going to interrupt, and we are not going to argue, and we are not going to cross-examine, and we're not going to contradict. We're going to say, listen, this relationship is really super important to me, and I think it's important to you, but I don't know exactly how. And so I'm really afraid that I don't know where this goes, but I know that this is not an emotional place for us to be living. So I'm hoping that there's a misunderstanding that's at the root of some of this. So what I want to do is I want you to tell me everything that's going on with how does you feel, what you're upset with me about, what you're disappointed with me about, etc. And I will listen to this, and I'm not going to argue with you, and I'm not going to contradict you, and I'm not going to interrupt you. I may ask you for clarity, but I want to hear it all, because that's the only way out is for us to understand. Okay? You can, that in principle is exactly what I do with couples. And as a third party, I say to them, I need to understand. Okay? And so right in front of each other, we go through this process. And we can also, you know, I get fancier because we'll also do this with flood the circuit first, which is a huge technique. And so before you would ask a partner to do this, you might need to flood his or her circuit. And you say, listen, here's why I want to have this conversation. And this is the deal. I value this. I value that. You're amazing about this. You're amazing about that. This is what we have together. Blah, 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 blah. Super valuable to me. Okay. But I'm hurt and I'm angry and I'm worried and I'm anxious and I'm thinking about leaving and I'm thinking that you're thinking about leaving and I'm thinking about, are we just being fools here and pretending that we have a relationship that's really not there? Like, what are we doing? And the only thing that I know how to do is to grit my teeth and try to find out what is, you know, what is, where you're really at, where I've done things that you might have misinterpreted, that have hurt your feelings. I don't have any idea. All I want to know is, what is the truth of where we're at? The truth is the only thing that can fix it. Many people will get a quarter of the way down this road. They smell that the truth smells bad, and they just back away and patch it up because they're not ready to face any defection yet. Or you know, they got reasons to continue. Okay, till the kid leaves for college. Then we're not even going to go to therapy. Screw it. We're out of here. Okay. that's obviously a super long-winded answer to a very good question, i.e., what can we do? And the answer is the only thing you can do is find out what the truth is. The truth is the only. Yeah, go ahead, Jen.
But the truth doesn't mean that it solves everything. It's
right.
It just brings everything to light. So people need to understand that, yeah, you can crystal clear and you get yourself out of the vicious cycle
Yes.
of the sniping and the bitterness and the misinterpretations. And so you clear that smoke out of the way.
Yes.
But there's still, the truth could be that there's a fundamental unsolvable conflict of interest here.
Yes.
And that's why you have all of the signaling going on.
Right.
So we hope that it's not.
Yes.
We hope that it is a solvable problem, possibly downstream from an unsolvable problem that you can live with.
Right.
But, you know, you have to, the crystal clear process is bringing that into the light and looking at it from every angle and figuring that out and getting out of the defensiveness and the avoidance and everything else that sort of masks it.
Yeah.
So it's not like a cure-all.
No.
It doesn't mean that your relationship can be saved. It just means that if it can be, this is the only way it can be.
That's right. That is, and the I have a technique. I don't know if I've told people this technique. Maybe I have, and God knows, might be buried in, you know, Beat Your Jeans 113. Who the heck knows at this point?
It's on the spreadsheet.
Yeah, I had a partner to me that was super important, and the. But there was a problem, and that partner would get very anxious and think that I was defecting when I wasn't. And that person would, instead of just just crying. She had a characteristic of being really pissy as hell. And as a result of that, I would get defensive and irritated. And this went on for quite a while. As it started to look like this was an impasse, a process that couldn't be solved. The next thing that I did was I actually tried to exercise tremendous patience and self-control to not do that, to not fight back fire with fire and with overwhelming her with evidence, but instead listen to her super carefully while I let her essentially process her anxiety and her suspicions. Okay. When I did that, then I would be very calmly trying to go through the evidence with her and really try to show her, no, actually that isn't true. Turns out that didn't work. Okay. So the very best that I had failed. Okay. So it turned out that something else worked, and I don't know how I came up with it. I just did it. I just did it one day, and it was like a last ditch type of experiment, because these kinds of quote arguments and airing of the grievances and anger and suspicion and hostility, all this stuff, these things would be, you know, could be a 4-hour process or a 2-hour process that would then linger for 3 weeks. And it's like, man, this is just too outrageously time and energy expensive and emotionally expensive. And so one day I decided to gamble on a shortcut. And I just, when she's all hostile and pissed off, I actually went up to her and I put my arms around her. And I held her super tight to me, and I whispered in her ear, and I whispered about how valuable she was, okay? And I just kept doing that, and I just kept doing that. And I just, she was just frozen right there. Like, it's not like I'm a big, strong guy stopping her from backing up and whacking me. She could have. That wasn't the point. She knew this was me putting my wings around her, okay? And what happened after about the first, you know, 30 or 40 or 50 seconds as she started sobbing. Okay. And then a little while later, she started laughing while she was crying. And then she said, "You're tricking me." That was hilarious. Okay. In other words, "I'm suspicious that you're cheating and that you're scheming and blah, blah, blah. I think you're tricking me because now I'm feeling really reassured and I'm relieved as hell." Okay. It's hilarious. Okay. And so that turned out to be unbelievably effective. All right. Now, so i.e., what is the truth of the relationship? My previous estimation of the truth was, I can't get through to this chick. I can't do it. I've given my very best. You know, I'm a 20-year, 25-year veteran psychologist, for Christ's sakes. And I am doing everything I can on multiple shots at this thing, and I cannot get through, and I'm at the end of my rope. Okay? And then one day I decide, screw it. I don't know what it was, just some right brain bolt of thing. Maybe I saw it in a movie. I don't know why, but I did it.
Maybe Good Will Hunting.
Okay? I had nothing to lose. And I did this, and it was astounding. And as a result of that, that changed my eggshells and anxiety and worries about where her mind was at, because if it turned out that Old Faithful was going to go off a month later, which it generally would, then I had a weapon. And I you know, it's like, oh, it worked again, worked the second time, oh, worked the third time. Okay. And so it just always worked. So what did we get down to? Well, I found down at the heart of the esteem dynamic, I found another way, rather than arguing and contradicting and blah, 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 trying to convince, I found a different way to do it. And as a result, took an enormous burden off that relationship. So that's why, you know, there's nothing like life experience and desperation and, you know what I mean? And and just sort of, you know, clinical experience, et cetera. So sometimes when we feel like we're in an impasse, we might not be. There just may be another way we have to go about communicating something that we desperately need communicated and understood and believed. So that's just another little caveat to it's, you know, we're not necessarily exactly sure where we are, but we usually do know. You know, we usually know, but that doesn't mean that there isn't some digging to do that might be very fruitful. And that's what we're here for.
I think maybe you intuited that technique because there's a fundamental, just like we will often say, if you don't understand a situation, look for the status, right?
Yes.
It's kind of this truism of human relationships. Mm-hmm. I have this harebrained hypothesis that mm-hmm. when it comes to male-female relations, mm-hmm. Often the kernel of the conflict for her is about abandonment, and for
yes.
him it's about respect.
Yes.
And so, you know, if all else fails, kind of turning it to look at it from that angle and being like, is there an issue of abandonment here for her that is coming up? And so you're feeling that at some level, and maybe even like left brain identifying it, but it's not until you address it by swaddling her.
Yes.
and making her feel very safe and protected and included and loved, that she can relax. And so, yeah, I can totally see how that works.
Didn't work in the end.
Melts the defensiveness. No,
but that was fair. In other words, but it was a massive improvement and a very important lesson.
Well, and it allows the unresolvable conflict to be fully exposed and examined.
Yes,
and, you know,
exactly.
Until you get there and you look at it and decide, is this something we can live with or not?
Right.
Until you distill it down to its essence, you don't know. All you know is all of the noise and defensiveness and craziness.
Yes.
So you have to get out of that to figure out if it is something that you can move forward with.
Wonderful.
Yeah. You know, how do you think about that? What do you think about that writing job?
Well, I don't know. What's our deadline?
Yeah. For those of you that don't know, you know, we're working on a book that is, it shows right on the website that you can sign up for, that it's going to be published in 2021.
Yeah, we should probably edit that page.
Oh my goodness. That's
all
right.
There's progress.
There's progress.
We did share a chapter, but there's a lot more where that came from. And we are, yes, we're moving forward. But for everybody who always asks for a date, we're not working with a publisher. We're self-publishing. And so, you know, it's not a situation where we do have a deadline hovering over us. And as people may be aware, the world's gone through some pretty major changes in the last couple of years, which we want to make sure we address somewhat substantially in the book as well. So
all good.
A lot
more
to do.
More about supply chain delays, I guess that's what we call it.
Yeah,
it's exactly. It's supply chain problems.
Yeah. All right, Nathan, I think we're
Dr.
good.
Dr. Lyle, thank you so much for winding out on that. Dr. Hawk, thank you so much for your contribution. This is amazing. We really love to hear all these perspectives and all these possibilities. Really appreciate it. We will look forward to talking with you guys next show. And I hope you guys have a wonderful, wonderful night.
All right. Thank you, Nathan.
Sounds good.
Thanks for listening.
Gotcha.
If you like what you hear, subscribe.
Bye.
Write us a review or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.